I'm Jen Psaki. Welcome to The World Unpacked. We break down the most important global issues with experts, journalists, and policymakers. We ask the questions you want answers to in order to get smart on foreign policy.
The whole of Hong Kong will revert to China.
Now, Hong Kong people are to run Hong Kong.
These are fundamental freedoms, and they must continue.
And Hong Kong is in an odd situation. It's a limited democracy inside a communist country.
The people of Hong Kong have brandished their umbrellas and taken to the streets again, the city's latest attempt to guard its unique way of life from the encroachments of the Chinese government, have produced some of the most highly attended protests ever witnessed. What does Hong Kong's long simmering dispute with Beijing ultimately boil down to? And what does the showdown between protesters and Hong Kong's leaders mean for the city's future? To give us a sense of how things look on the ground in Hong Kong, I'm joined by Christy Lu Stout. Christy is an anchor and correspondent for CNN based in Hong Kong. Christy, thanks for joining me and welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
I want to start with some history, because many of our listeners know something's happening in Hong Kong, but they don't know quite what it's all about. So Hong Kong spent a century as a British colony before returning to Chinese rule in 1997. What was the feeling at that time about the change in rule? What was the expectation? And why did it happen?
Yeah, well, 1997, that was the handover. That was when it was agreed upon for Hong Kong to return to mainland China. There was a lot of fear and uncertainty at that time. Property market turmoil, a lot of people making sure that they were lining up additional country passports to places like Canada and the UK. But since then, you know, there has been this ongoing test over this governing principle that has governed Hong Kong since then. This term of a phrase that you keep hearing, one country, two systems, where, you know, bizarrely, you have this place, Hong Kong, that is simultaneously part of China, but also not China at the same time. You know, it's a special administrative region of Hong Kong. And yet here you see rights and freedoms that people can express here in Hong Kong that are not seen in the mainland. In fact, Jen, just want to tell you right now, I'm in the control room of our Hong Kong studio here at CNN, and I'm looking at this live feed of this event happening right now in the central business district of Hong Kong. Additional protests happening at this moment. And what's really interesting is, as you've been following the story, there's been messaging about for the chief executive to stand down or for the extradition bill to be withdrawn. I know we're going to get into the nitty-gritty of that in just a moment. But the signs are changing. I'm looking at a man holding a sign saying, "Free Hong Kong and democracy now." And it's quite remarkable to see this evolution in messaging about this protest. And this all goes into just the identity of Hong Kong and what the people of Hong Kong want Hong Kong to be.
And that's so interesting. And thank you for sharing that with us, especially as you're looking out your window, as you said. So it sounds like from what you're saying, you wouldn't have expected that just a couple of years ago or even months ago. So how has kind of and I know we'll get into the protests in a little bit, but how has the kind of relationship between Hong Kong and mainland China changed over the last couple of years, both at the government level and among people?
Yeah, well, over the years, we've seen people in Hong Kong actively exercising their rights, you know, that they have being a semi-autonomous part of China, you know, with regular protests. You know, for example, there was that protest that happened, it happens every year on July 1 on the anniversary of the handover. There's also that protest that took place in 2012 when we saw students and additional Hong Kongers successfully challenging this proposed introduction of a patriotic education in the local curriculum. They successfully forced the government's hand. But then things started to change around 2014. You know, we all know what happened with the pro-democracy umbrella movement protests, generated a lot of attention, did not generate democracy. And since then, we have seen what many critics here in Hong Kong say is this constant erosion of Hong Kong autonomy, you know, with the kidnappings of Hong Kong booksellers by mainland Chinese agents. There was an abduction of a Chinese tycoon at the Four Seasons Hotel here in Hong Kong. The denial of a visa for Victor Mallet, the prominent Financial Times journalist. Now, all this being cited as examples of Hong Kong's autonomy that is enshrined in the Basic Law just being eroded before the time when Hong Kong is supposed to be fully handed over to China, which is 2047.
I wanted to ask you about the chief executive, Carrie Lam, and her relationship with mainland China and the perception of her? Because if you're listening to kind of coverage of this and Angers like yourself talking about it, you want to kind of know more about her. What's her deal? You know, who is she? Whose side is she on? And what's the perception of her there?
I had the opportunity to interview her a couple years ago, just after she was elected, or critics would say selected, to become the first female chief executive of Hong Kong. That happened in 2017. Because there is no universal suffrage in Hong Kong. She was chosen by a small election committee dominated by pro-Beijing interests. You know, in fact, many protesters like to point out, in the city of 7 million people, she was selected by 777 people. And she
That's a stunning number.
Yeah, it's a lot of sevens in there, and not necessarily a number that really represents that she has the people behind her. And her job is a tough one, you know, because she has to serve two masters. She has to serve Beijing and the people of Hong Kong. And when I sat down with her, you know, I asked her, is that tough? You know, how are you going to do that? And she said, it's not tough. It's unique. And I also asked her, do you consider yourself to be a Hong Konger? And it seems like a simple question, but actually it's a very substantial one. A lot of people here in Hong Kong would say that they are Hong Kongers first. They're not Chinese, they're Hong Kongers. And they're asserting their autonomy, they're asserting their identity being separate and distinct from mainland China. So when I asked her that question, you know, Carrie Lam, do you consider yourself as a Hong Konger first? She said, you know, it's not a matter of first or second. I'm a Hong Kong person, I'm a Chinese person, and I want to contribute to Hong Kong. And I think that really characterizes Carrie Lam, you know, who she is, and the very, very difficult position that she is put into, being chief executive of Hong Kong.
When we come back, we'll take a look at the current protests.
Hong Kong's just had one of its biggest ever protests in history.
The extradition bill has created new tensions and fueled anger among pro-democracy politicians.
Afraid people are also angry.
It's about the status of Hong Kong and the power China has over it.
The latest protests were sparked by a government proposal to amend Hong Kong's extradition treaty. Rather than seeing it as a dry piece of legalese, many Hong Kongers think this proposal gravely threatens their freedom and safety. Why is that? And what changes were involved, or proposed, I should say?
This controversial piece of legislation is the extradition bill. It would allow the extradition of suspected criminals to a number of additional jurisdictions, including mainland China. The Hong Kong government, their line is, they say that this is needed. This is necessary to plug this legal loophole. And they keep pointing to this murder case, this really grisly murder case that took place in Taiwan, where you have a 20-year-old Hong Kong woman allegedly killed by her boyfriend while on holiday. Now, under the current law, he cannot be sent to Taiwan to face justice. But critics say that they're not buying that. They're afraid that this new law would be abused because they're afraid of the Chinese legal system. They're afraid that China would use it to extradite, you know, political dissidents or NGO workers or critics of Beijing to mainland China. And once they're there, once they're extradited, they wouldn't get a fair trial.
And, you know, you mentioned a little bit earlier the 2014 protests and the reaction at the time to a kind of another proposal, which was to pre-screen candidates for Hong Kong's top post. Have you seen, just watching this and covering it as closely as you are there differences? Are there similarities? Are there tactics or things that the protesters have learned from 2014?
Yeah, you know, that's an absolutely astute question on multiple levels. And one is, I think the umbrella movement has set the stage for where we are today. You know, one could argue that, you know, on one hand, the umbrella movement failed to deliver universal suffrage. But on the other hand, it created a new political party. It radicalized a new generation. In fact, a new generation of protesters who are really bold, some of them even asking for not just greater democracy or democracy as promised in the Basic Law, but asking for independence. Now, talking about tactics, we have seen a very, very interesting evolution in tactics. Okay, but to separate out the different crowds that we've seen, videos of reports of the coverage of the Hong Kong protests, you know, there's the June 9th protest, and then 1 week later, the other Sunday protest, where you see, according to organizers, millions of people out and about, you know, just saying that they want Carrie Lam to stand down, saying that they want this extradition bill withdrawn. That basically cuts across the board in terms of demographics. You know, you see senior citizens, you see families with young children, you see students, you see even people from the business sector going out there. There was widespread opposition. But when you look at the core protest movement, these are the young people that you see, you know, in photographs or video wearing the black T-shirts, wearing the masks. This is the more radicalized younger generation, and they have new tactics. And, you know, for example, this is a leaderless movement, you know, quite unlike the umbrella movement in 2014, where you had figures like Joshua Wong and Nathan Law. There are no protest leaders. And some people believe that that's intentional because after the umbrella movement protest, you know, authorities quickly arrested the leaders of that movement. Also, the protesters are much more anonymous this time. They're wearing masks, you know, not only to, you know, in fear of, let's say, pepper spray being used or what have you, but to actively hide their identities. You know, these protesters have been using pay-as-you-go Metro cards instead of the Octopus smart cards. They're using more secure messaging apps. So that is a very, very, you know, noticeable change. Also, they're more organized. There were posters and images of that show the hand gestures, that decode the hand gestures that the protesters were seen using. You know, hand gestures like sign language to indicate gas mask or zip ties or asthma puffer. And it's remarkable to see that because, again, this is a leaderless movement.
And you had mentioned that you were looking out your window and these protests were ongoing. Where do they kind of go from here? Is the momentum, you know, supporting these protests just continuing, or what should we be looking for in them?
Well, to clarify, I'm in our studio and I'm looking at a live video feed.
You're not actually looking out the window.
But it is a but it's a virtual window into what's happening a couple districts away. And you know, they are trying to keep up the momentum, especially ahead of July 1, which is traditionally a big protest day. It's the anniversary of the handover. But what we're seeing today is they are pegging their protest to the upcoming G20 summit in Osaka. Earlier today, we saw, you know, basically about 1,000 or so protesters going from consulate to consulate with letters to give to leaders of these diplomatic missions asking for their support to withdraw the extradition bill. You know, so they were going from, you know, the U.S. consulate to the South Korean consulate to the Japanese one to the EU diplomatic mission. And, you know, a very bold gesture because this comes a couple of days after the Chinese foreign ministry basically said China will not allow Hong Kong to be discussed at the upcoming G20 summit. So Hong Kong protesters are capitalizing on this big international event to say, do you know what, we're going to force this as a point of discussion. This is, as you know, I've been following very closely, something that, you know, the U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has said that human rights will be discussed when Trump and Xi Jinping have this, you know, opportunity to sit down. But, you know, the protesters are being really nimble. They're being creative. They're trying to peg their protest to this major international event to just keep the momentum up and to keep the pressure up on the government.
And what do you think will feel satisfying to them? I mean, having sat in on a lot of these diplomatic meetings, oftentimes human rights and issues like this come up at the very end of a meeting, right? They come up so that, you know, a country like the United States or others can say, oh, we did raise it. But will that satisfy them? And what impact would that even have on the Chinese, in your view?
Yeah, I mean, right now, what would satisfy the protesters is something that only Carrie Lam could deliver at the moment. You know, they want the bill not to be indefinitely suspended. They want it withdrawn. They want Carrie Lam to step down. And also, this is interesting, the longer that Carrie Lam has been sort of just waffling on the issue or just not providing a meaningful apology, you know, et cetera, the list of demands is getting longer as well. So in addition to asking for the bill's withdrawal and for Carrie Lam to step down, they also want an investigation of police brutality against protesters because of those scenes that played out on June the 12th. They want a recharacterization of police action from a quote-unquote riot to a protest. They want the release of arrested protesters. And we're looking at these signs that these protesters are holding out and about in the streets of Hong Kong this evening saying, free Hong Kong, democracy now. I mean, it appears that they're asking for democracy as well, that the universal suffrage debate that came up during the umbrella movement is now back in the mix as well. Their list of demands has gotten much, much longer.
So it's moved much beyond the extradition treaty, which has obviously received quite a bit of attention and coverage, but it's bigger than that, it sounds like.
Absolutely. It's become something much, much bigger than that.
And so do you, I mean, Carrie Lam, why wouldn't she just, you know, get rid of the extradition treaty? That won't satisfy them entirely, as you've said, but is there a possibility she'll bring it back? Is that why?
You know, it's interesting because the protesters, it could be said that the protesters have already scored a major victory. You know, when they announced that the extradition bill was suspended indefinitely, that was seen as a win. And I spoke to one pro-Beijing Hong Kong lawmaker, his name Tommy Chung, who told me that, look, accept it. The result is equivalent to the withdrawal of the bill. But protesters, as you've seen, these protesters continue. They're not seeing it that way at all. You know, there was even pressure among other pro-Beijing lawmakers I've spoken to in Hong Kong. They're saying that Carrie Lam should just go ahead and withdraw the bill just to defuse the situation. One pro-establishment figure told me that Carrie Lam can't step down. You know, she has, you know, Beijing has her back. They don't want her to step down. That would reopen the entire universal suffrage debate, et cetera, et cetera. But the bill can be withdrawn to defuse the situation. But it hasn't. And one wonders, you know, why.
After the break, we're going to look ahead to the future of Hong Kong and the role of China.
We don't want Hong Kong to become just another Chinese city.
Concerns the future of the Hong Kong, but also would reflect on China's future.
But there's still time to change things. The future is still in our hands.
Chinese President Xi Jinping has built control over all the territories Beijing claims, including, of course, Hong Kong and Taiwan, as a key test of his ability to rule a strong nationalist China. What is his ultimate goal for this relationship?
It's, you know, back in 2017, that was the 20th anniversary of the Hong Kong handover. And that was also the moment when Xi Jinping finally made his first visit to the territory as Chinese president. So all the journalists here were hanging on to his every word when he gave his prepared remarks. And he said, you know, as expected, Hong Kong, you know, he's a backer of Hong Kong. Hong Kong is in my heart. He also said, you know, Beijing would ensure, you know, one country, two systems will continue with stability, right? You know, very safe words, expected words. But one wonders, what is he thinking now, especially in light of these protests? We know that it's a very sensitive point. You know, as we discussed earlier, you have a top Chinese official saying Beijing is not going to allow Hong Kong to be brought up at the G20 summit, you know, even though Secretary Pompeo said it should be up for discussion. One pro-establishment figure here in Hong Kong said that there is no doubt. I asked her, how is Beijing viewing this right now? Is Beijing a bit upset with Carrie Lam? Is Beijing a bit upset about the situation here? You know, and she said there is no doubt Beijing is upset because of one particular reason. And that reason is Taiwan. Because in Taiwan, this is interesting, because in Taiwan, the Hong Kong extradition bill is seen as a warning against one country, two systems, that one country, two systems, and this model does not work. And this is a model that Beijing was hoping to use to entice Taiwan back into the fold.
It's interesting. I wanted to ask you, we've talked a bit about Carrie Lam, but just as we're looking ahead, how does she manage this relationship moving forward? And what is her ultimate goal?
She needs to serve out her term. You know, is the term of the Office of Chief Executive is 5 years with a maximum of 2 consecutive terms. She came in office in 2017, so her term would be up in 2021. You know, Beijing has said that they back her, even in light of these extradition protests. They say that they have her back, you know, amid this ongoing, protest action, et cetera. And, you know, Beijing may no doubt believe in her loyalty, but there are probably doubts about how effective she is for Hong Kong. One political analyst I spoke to said that she could serve out the rest of her term as almost like a lame duck chief executive. You know, she would not dare to implement any controversial policies until her replacement would come in. You know, she's facing just so many challenges, you know, lack of trust with Beijing, between Hong Kong and Beijing. She's now dealing with a new urban, some people are calling it guerrilla protest movement. And then there are greater problems that Hong Kong has been dealing with in recent years, like a lack of social mobility, economic opportunity for all Hong Kongers. You know, but now, because of this miscalculation with the extradition bill, she, you know, it seems that what she can do right now is just serve out the rest of her time as this political analyst put it, lame duck CE.
And before I let you go, Christy, I just wanted to ask you, I mean, the Hong Kong's current governing system famously will expire after 50 years in 2047. I realize that's a long time from now, but not that long. So what might post-2047 Hong Kong look like?
You know, 2047 is not that far away, and you're right. And there is a lot of fear. You know, Hong Kongers have, for years now, and especially now, been talking about their exit plan. You know, are they going to get that Canadian passport? Are they going to get that British passport? And there's a lot of anxiety. It wasn't a surprise when I saw on Twitter that the Hong Kong Red Cross opened up a psychological support hotline on the back of these extradition bill protests, because people are legitimately fearful and anxious about, you know, what is going to happen next to Hong Kong. And Hong Kongers are fearful because they've seen China's human rights record and what's happened inside mainland China, you know, with what's happened to activists there, the situation in Xinjiang and Tibet as well. And you have to feel for the people of Hong Kong, you know, and when you see them out protesting in 30 degrees Celsius plus weather, this is, you know, very, very hot temperatures, you know, students, families, business people, senior citizens, because they have only tasted one type of life, you know, freedom in Hong Kong. This is the only home that they know. And that's why they protest. Sometimes you talk to the protesters and you say, do you really think you're going to make a difference? And they say, you know, some of them say, no, I don't think I'm going to make a difference, but I have the ability to fight. So I'm going to fight until the end. And that's why you see them march. You know, they march because this is the only home that they know. And that's what's so incredible about this story and these events in Hong Kong.
Well, Christy Lustau, thank you for sharing your expertise and your perspective. And we'll look forward to continuing to follow your coverage of this and many other issues on CNN. I appreciate you taking the time to be on The World Unpacked.
Jen, thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to The World Unpacked, which is produced by the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. For more information and to subscribe, you can find us at worldunpacked.com. Don't forget to rate the show. It helps other people find us. Our audio engineer is Tim Martin, and our executive producer is Lauren Duick.